Can brain training games make you smarter, improve your memory, help you focus better at work or school?
It'd be really nice if you could play some games and have it radically change your cognitive abilities. And it's still possible that it might be, it's just that the studies up to this point really don't provide strong evidence.
That's U of I psychology professor Daniel Simons on Morning Edition. We'll talk with him about his new in-depth review on the science behind brain games. We'll also meet a Carl medical doctor who's taken multiple trips overseas to help Syrian refugees.
Everything around them is so dirty, everything around them is so poor, that something as simple as a mosquito bite could almost kill a person.
Plus, Chicago musician Justin Roberts on his latest kids' music album, Lemonade. That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned.
This is how we tell everyone. This is how we bring in the sun.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Maybe you've heard or seen ads for brain training games. Maybe you've even tried them out yourself. Those are games you can play online or on your computer. The companies that sell these games claim they will improve your memory, attention span, help you focus, and resist distractions better. This is a big business. In 2013, Americans spent about $322 million on digital brain health software products. And one of those companies, Lumosity, got in trouble with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission for deceptive advertising in January of this year. Full disclosure for our audience, Lumosity has provided financial support, otherwise known as underwriting, in the public media world for NPR. That's probably where you've heard that name before. It's not just the FTC. A new exhaustive review of the literature performed by a team of researchers, including two psychology professors at the University of Illinois, Daniel Simons and Elizabeth Stein Morrow, say so far those claims are too good to be true. Both of them are in studio with me now. Dan, Liz, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
And for everyone who's listening at home, if you have questions about this, if you've tried brain games yourself, if you have a question for our researchers, the number to call is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet right now as well to 21st Show. That's 21st Show. Before we dive into this article, for people who haven't played brain games before, I know this morning our entire staff was playing them so we could get a sense of what they are. Dan, can you describe how do you define what a brain game is in terms of what you all looked at in terms of this research?
So I should say what we were looking at was not just brain games, which might be fun little cognitive tasks that are turned into games. We were looking at brain training more generally. And we use brain training in scare quotes because in many cases we're not actually training the brain, we're just training our cognitive abilities. So these companies are a variety of companies, and they use different sorts of techniques. Some involve really intensive practice on difficult, cognitive, boring tasks on computers for many, many, many hours that get more and more difficult as you get better. Those are not the typical things you would go and find on the web at Lumosity, for example. But there also are games like Lumosity's games, which are a whole bunch of short, little, fun games that you practice and get better at over time.
And what's the difference between training your brain versus training your cognitive abilities?
In the context of this literature, nothing.
Okay. And when we think about this, we ask people actually, by the way, on Facebook what they think about brain games. And Kristen says she finds them to be fun. Kristen says, my friends in psychology and neuroscience say brain training is a scam. You might get better at an individual game because of your practice, but does that make your brain any better overall?
Well, it makes your brain better at playing that particular game.
Okay.
So that's right? So
but
that's,
and then this is the big question,
right.
And this is what you all did this research review, Liz. Does that then translate into making your brain better overall?
Well, first of all, nobody ever tests the effects of brain training on the brain. So we actually have very little or no evidence on that at all. But there have been a lot of people that have looked at the effects of playing these games on cognition or different aspects of cognitive ability. And the research just isn't there. I mean, some of it's just not very good quality research. So it's not that this never works under any circumstances. We just don't have the evidence for it yet.
Those of us, I think, Liz, those of us who are not scientists or neuroscientists or psychologists see these studies and we all think that doing this kind of – and I think probably different media headlines may contribute to this. We think, well, doing these kind of things help your brain stay active and this can stave off things like Alzheimer's.
Right. There's actually been some work looking at the effects of playing these games on resistance to pathology, and there's no evidence for that. But there is some evidence for lifestyle with respect to Alzheimer's. So people that are well-educated tend to be more resistant to the symptoms of Alzheimer's in the face of pathology, psychopathology. So there's some brain pathology that goes along with Alzheimer's that ultimately shows up in behavior. But the theory there is that if you are engaged in lifelong education, if you've created this what's called cognitive reserve, you've basically created some, you know, over knitting of the network. So when the pathology strikes, then you've got a little more resistance. So even that, I mean, obviously the evidence for that is correlational. That is, we look at
right, because you might think maybe people who are well educated maybe are in a better socioeconomic class, maybe getting better nutrition or all those things, and we really don't know if that's maybe the correlation as opposed to the causation.
Yeah, that could play a little bit of a role, but there's statistical techniques that have been used to parse out those variables. So I'm a little I don't think it's definitive, but a lot of work needs to be done here. But I mean, I'm a little more optimistic about education, literacy, substantive, lifelong habits. But it's not. But again, it's what we know for sure is that you get better at what you do. So if you want to play chess, don't try to play brain games to increase your working memory capacity to play chess.
Just
play
keep chess. Playing chess. If you have questions or comments for Liz or Dan, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. Dan, let's get into the review article because it starts off, and this is the thing I think sometimes is confusing for people. It starts off with two different consensus statements that were published from two different groups of scientists from around the world within months of each other, back to back in 2014. And one of them said brain games do not improve brain function, and the other said, yes, they do. So how is it that two groups of reputable scientists, assuming both of those were reputable scientific groups, how could they arrive at such dramatically different conclusions while looking at the same evidence?
It's an excellent question. Partly, I think that they weren't looking at the evidence in the right ways. Right? So the first letter was written based on a long history, one that we review in the paper, on what's known as transfer of training. If you practice one thing, does that make you better at other things that might not be directly related? So if you practice memory, does it improve your performance on other memory tasks in other contexts and with other materials and, in your daily life? And there's a long history looking at transfer of training and showing that when you practice something, you get better at that thing and maybe things that are really, really similar to it, but not at things that are much different from it or in different contexts. So the people who wrote the initial letter, skeptical of the claims from brain training companies that playing these games or doing these practice tasks could improve your work performance or your driving or the other sorts of things that they make claims about, we're highly skeptical of it because there really isn't strong evidence for that, historically or in the literature. The brain training proponents are coming at this from a slightly different perspective. They are looking at the totality of the evidence and saying, hey, look, there are hundreds of papers showing suggestive things about the benefits. But nobody prior to this review had actually looked at the evidence provided by any of the individual articles in depth and reviewed all of the evidence to see both how much is there, what's the quantity of evidence, and is it good evidence.
And that's what you guys did.
That's what we did.
And what did you find?
What we found was that there really was not compelling evidence for broad transfer of training from these simple tasks that you practice extensively to things that you actually care about and do in the real world. That doesn't mean it might not work, but it means that there's not really compelling evidence for it yet. Most of the studies had major design and analysis flaws and major reporting flaws that made it hard to interpret whether there was any evidence at all.
And when we think about this too, we also wonder – I mean, when we think about the research, what do we know about who commissioned the research? When you looked at all of those studies, are some of them done by companies that are like Lumosity or other companies that are saying, hey – this is why there's scientific research to suggest that this is helpful doing this.
So some are conducted by the companies themselves, but actually a lot of the research that the companies cite as support for their claims was done independently of the companies and was often done before the companies. So the biggest trial, for example, the ACTIV trial, was initiated largely before most of these companies started marketing their research. There are studies that have been done by the companies, and whenever that happens, whenever the authors are members of the organization, whenever they're employed by the company, you do have to look at that a little more skeptically. That doesn't mean it's poorly done, but they have an incentive to only publish things that they think worked, and they might very easily hide things that didn't.
And that, I think that's the point, because you point out in your paper, Dan, Lumosity has a bibliography on their website of 46 papers, posters, and scientific presentations. Now, they're not just the only company out there. There's Posit Science, Brain HQ, CogMed, CogniFit. How is the average person supposed to critically evaluate these kind of claims? If there's 46 scientific papers, does that mean it must be true?
In the case of Lumosity, there aren't 46 scientific papers. Most of the things that were on their website wouldn't count as scientific publications and wouldn't provide strong evidence. A couple of the companies cite a lot more evidence. So CogMed and Posit Science both cite a lot more peer-reviewed journal articles on research in this literature. But it's a really hard problem for your average consumer who doesn't necessarily know how to pick through the statistics of a journal article on this stuff to make sense of what to believe and what not to believe. One of the things we tried to do in this paper is to provide a set of recommendations and tips for somebody who wants to evaluate a study. You hear about some new brain training study in the media. How can you evaluate it? And we present a set of guidelines that you can use that should be fairly easy to follow that allows you to kind of ask, is this a good study or is it not?
We're speaking with Dan Simons and Elizabeth Stein Morrow, both of them at the University of Illinois, both of them taking part in this research. Dan, so what are those guidelines for people who want to know how to critically evaluate this? What do you suggest they do?
Sure. So there are a few big ones you can look at. First, did they test a lot of people? Because if they didn't test a lot of people,
and
it's
more
likely
to be
noisy. Well, the best of the studies in this literature are testing hundreds or even a couple of thousand of participants. If you see a study that tests 10 participants, be very skeptical.
Just cut in here and say that Dan mentioned the ACTIV trial, and that is one study that had over 2,000 participants, and it's some of the best evidence we have for lack of transfer of training, is that people that were trained in speed of processing, they got faster on those particular tasks.
They were just getting good at those tasks.
Those tasks. They didn't get better at even everyday versions of those tasks, like trying to find groceries on a grocery shelf more quickly.
Right. So one of those – so Dan, you said the number of people in the study. What else?
So another thing, and the thing that was probably the biggest consistent problem we found in this literature was using a control group that wasn't well matched. So imagine you're doing a drug study, right? And you're trying to test out this new drug that you think is going to be really effective. And you give people the drug and they improve. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean the drug was effective, right? So for example, you have a new antibiotic and you want to try it out for children with ear infections. Well, you could give it to them and find, hey, a week later, they've improved. But it might also be the case that they'd improve if you gave them nothing at all. And they might have improved because you gave them something and they thought it was going to help them. So what you really need to do is match their experience and their expectations and check against a baseline. So in a drug trial, you can give people a sugar pill, and that acts as a placebo, and it matches everything about the intervention, all of the expectations for improvement, what the experimenters expect, what they know about you, other than the critical ingredient in the intervention.
Well, and I wondered about – and Liz, I wonder if you could speak to this placebo effect, because I wonder if people doing these games think they're doing better and if that makes a difference. Is that a possibility?
Well, that could be why some of the studies seem to show effects, is they don't have good control groups. So the control group is somebody, say, who was doing looking at an educational DVD or not doing anything at all. So they know that they're not receiving cognitive training, so they're not going to expect to get better. So that's a big problem.
You can make that more specific. Imagine you did 50 hours of playing Tetris, right, versus 50 hours of watching DVDs. And now I give you an outcome test that asks you to rotate shapes in your head. Which group do you think will do better? Everybody would say, well, of course, practicing 50 hours of Tetris where you're rotating shapes is going to make you better at that. And if I ask you which one's going to make you better at answering questions about a story, well, maybe the DVDs, but definitely not the Tetris one. So the problem with these sorts of interventions is it's really difficult to have the equivalent of a placebo pill, because people know what it is that they're doing for 10 or 25 or 50 hours.
So people need to look at the size of the study population, look at whether or not they use control groups. Anything else?
Look at whether that control group is likely to lead to the same kinds of expectations to improve.
That said, Liz, what would you like? Like, the thing is it seems like right now there aren't studies – that have been designed in a way you all think could properly test this. How do you think, how would you like to see a study like this designed?
Oh, that's a really good question. So the, as Dan said, the control group issue is really, really hard. But one kind of clever thing to do is to try to find a version of the task that has all of the components except some critical component. So if you think working memory is going to improve, so the working memory is the ability to hold things in memory while you manipulate some information. And if you could have all the components of that except maybe the memory component, so it looks like the same kind of a task and it's fast like the same kind of, some challenge to it, so you really believe that gets at it. Dan's also done some work with looking, just actually measuring people's expectancies, and that's another way to get at that.
We had one comment on Facebook. David said he's tried Lumosity but found that reading a challenging book did more to stimulate his mind. Also, I think playing chess or Go, given its high game complexity, are good alternatives. What do you think? Do you think that we should be thinking of things like this instead?
Well, you know, that's, reading is a really interesting example. In fact, we just got funded by NIH to look at a literacy intervention for older adults. The thing about reading is that people reading in while their brains are scanned are showing a lot of mental activity. We know that reading is a highly engaging mental activity. It also opens up pathways to learn new things in lots of different domains. And that's very different from brain games where you're practicing decontextualized tasks that have nothing to do with anything in real life.
I think that's a critical point, right? So things like – there's actually evidence that doing things like doing crossword puzzles don't make you better at other things. They make you better at doing crossword puzzles. They improve your vocabulary. Doing things like chess may teach you things about strategy that then you can transfer to other things. But the key is being able to learn in a wide range of contexts. And one of the things that's great about school, for example, as a form of brain training, is that you're learning to use the same information in lots of different ways and in lots of different contexts.
And the same skills in lots of contexts.
So that's one of the takeaways from this. Thank you so much for getting into this a little bit more with us, helping people become better educated about how they can approach these things. Liz Stein-Morrow at the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois. Daniel Simons with the Psychology Department. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stay tuned to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Booth. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Days. That's how long the crisis in Syria has been unfolding. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. Millions of people, half the country's population, has fled. In September, the United Nations said the people of Aleppo right now are facing the worst humanitarian crisis in Syria's five-year war. With all the people who fled the war-torn country bringing next to nothing with them, there's not surprisingly a growing need for medical care. We're joined in studio now by an Illinois doctor who's taken multiple trips overseas to provide medical care to Syrian refugees in camps. He just got back last week from a trip in Greece. Dr. Omar Elhiti is a doctor of internal medicine at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Dr. Elhiti, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You were in Greece for your most recent trip. You've been doing these with the Syrian American Medical Society. Can you describe for us what the conditions are like for refugee camps, the one that you were in last week?
Sure. So every camp is a little bit different. Every country is a little bit different. The ones in Greece are the most recent camps that have been established by the Greek government. I can say that the Greeks were in a rough situation before all this started, before they currently have 61,000 refugees that have come to shore and are now occupying Greece. So Greece was already in its own turmoil, let alone in this situation. So the refugee camps there are a little bit different than the camps elsewhere. They are scattered throughout the country, and there are various different sizes, various different locations. They have kind of somewhat segregated people based off their area of fleeing. You have camps that are somewhere around 600 people and other camps that are over 1,500 people. Some camps are next to major metropolitan areas, while some other camps are literally in the mountains, isolated from the rest of the world. So there are all these camps all throughout Greece. The ones I visited primarily were in an abandoned industrial city, with several of them, about 600 In population.
And when you go, do you go in, I imagine, with a team of medical doctors? Is there sort of, is there kind of a makeshift medical facilities that have been set up for people within the camp system? Or people maybe, is there one facility that people are coming to from other camps?
Again, this is a new thing in Greece. This is not something that the Greek government really volunteered for. So there are a lot of NGOs that have volunteered their time and effort and resources and have kind of divvied up the camp. So the organization that I work for, Syrian American Medical Society, or SAMS, they were responsible for four different camps, and they were the primary clinic at these camps. So it's through volunteering doctors throughout the U.S., throughout most of Europe, and some parts of the Middle East. They leave everything, donate their time and money, travel to these countries, and spend anywhere from a week to several months in these camps seeing patients of all different specialties.
And what motivated you to do this?
You know, you see all this stuff happen around you. You can't turn a blind eye. These are people that have done nothing to deserve this. These are there's not much difference between them and my family members. They were upstanding citizens living peacefully, and all of a sudden this chaos fell upon them. And I know, given my medical training, that I've been very fortunate and blessed to have resources that I can donate, whether it be my time, my money, or my skills. And it just was the responsible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. When people – what kind of medical condition are the patients that you're seeing? I imagine these are people who not just have fled war zones, but in some cases, if you're thinking about the people in Greece, they've been traveling a lot to get there.
Yeah. So, you know, the people in Greece, you'll see them from all walks of life. So the most commonly we hear about the Syrian refugees that are there, but they're not the only refugees that are there. There are several Iraqi refugees that have also fled that area. But really, refugees from all walks of the earth, including Pakistan, Afghanistan. You have Libyans and Moroccans, and everyone's kind of fled to this area, not for economic reasons. They're not kind of trying to get rich quick by going to Greece, but rather it's always the same story, right? Whether it's Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, or Syria, my ex-family member, whether it was their mother, father, brother, cousin, his house was bombed and they all died. And I wanted better for my family. I wanted safety for my family. And so I was willing to put myself and my family through this horrendous terrain, whether they walked, whether they took a car, whether they took a boat, whether they did all of the above to get to this Europe, which was in their mind an idea, a place, a safe haven for them, which actually didn't really turn out to be a safe haven. But that's the risks that they were willing to incur just to survive for their family, and that's why they went there. So, I mean, the Pakistani and Afghani refugees that we met literally walked from Pakistan and Afghanistan to Turkey, and then took a boat or raft, really, from Turkey to Greece. And it took them several months to get there. So,
and these are entire families, children,
yes.
Sometimes women who are pregnant.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the vast majority of these refugees that you see in these camps are women and children. They, I think, somewhat estimate 60%, but I think it's probably higher than that, as women and children. So that's who's doing this. And when they get on those boats, I mean, they're educated people. They know that they're risking their lives just getting on that small raft. They see the news just like everybody else sees the news. But that's a sign of how desperate they are. That's a sign of how bad their current situations are. So when we see these patients in refugee camps under living in tents, whole family of eight living in a tent with no running water, no electricity, just exposed to the terrain with very little food, no sources of income, and they're thankful to be there, I mean, imagine what they were going through when they were in Syria, Iraq, Pakistan, or Afghanistan.
And if they're thankful to be there, so you're treating people who I imagine have sometimes, some cases, pretty serious medical conditions, but do you find that the overwhelming emotional response of people is to be grateful?
Yeah, it also depends on which trip I go to. So the response of being how grateful they are is really depending on where I am. So the most grateful people I've ever seen are the people in Jordan. And those people are refugees that are unlike anybody I've ever met in my life. You know, they, like I said, they have the most horrendous living conditions. Their whole life is in limbo, yet they don't complain. They are very thankful people. They're very grateful people. They see visiting doctors and visiting humanitarians as a blessing. They see the efforts that other people go through to help them as something that they don't take lightly, and they're very, very thankful for that. And that just makes you want to help them more, right? So, and there's famous stories of, you know, as soon as you walk in, people invite you over for dinner. I mean,
have people done that with you?
Oh, absolutely.
And do they have food?
They barely have food, right? That's the whole paradox of the whole situation is that they barely have enough food for themselves. The malnutrition rates are astronomical, yet they insist on having you over for dinner. They insist on having you over tea. They insist on sharing their food with you. The kids walk up to you and they literally will share their bag of chips with you because they see your presence as a blessing. But, I mean, it really is just a humbling experience. That's the type of people that you're dealing with. And they're – what these people are asking for is just safety, security, and a future. They're not asking – for anything else, and that's nothing else that we would expect for our families and ask for our families. And that's why this cause is so great. It's because they're not asking for anything other than what we'd want for our own families.
I'm speaking with Dr. Omar Elhiti. He's a doctor of internal medicine at Carle Foundation Hospital. He's talking to us about the work that he's done in Jordan and Greece and different camps, working primarily with Syrian refugees, but as he's been saying, lots of refugees. And you said something about the horrendous conditions in the camps, and I wonder if you could explain that a little bit more, because I know that you've said even a mosquito bite could almost kill someone. How is that possible? You don't mean like a mosquito that's carrying a virus. You mean just a mosquito bite.
Not Zika, just a regular mosquito bite.
And how is that even possible?
You know, I was kind of surprised by that myself, to be honest. We had, when I just went back on this last trip, the weather was different than my previous trips. So there was a lot of mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes, people would come in with these mosquito bites and I wouldn't think too much of them. And I was kind of curious why. And then one of my colleagues said, just, you'll see why people are so worried about mosquito bites. And sure enough, within half a day's work, I had a 22-year-old kid come in with a huge, maybe like 6-centimeter gaping gash in his thigh that had just been washed out and debrided. And they showed me pictures of before. And I asked him, was it shrapnel? Was this a war attack? And he said, no, it was a mosquito bite. And it got super infected. And the reason it got infected is because of the horrendous conditions. Very little running water. No really running water. Water is provided to them. No sanitation. Everything is dirty. There's nothing. Nothing's clean there. So even their hands and mosquito bites itch, and you scratch it, and it gets infected. His was so infected that he had to be transferred to the hospital. He almost died, and he almost lost his leg. And he's only 20-something years old. When I saw him, the wound was fortunately healing, but he literally has to come to the clinic every day, and we personally wash him and deal him.
And when you're thinking about medications, about antibiotics and things like that, are you in situations where you have enough medications to treat people? Is it something where you have to be really careful about what you're rationing?
Everything is based off – all our resources are based off donations. So it's a lot of collaboration with organizations like MSF, like SAMS, a lot of humanitarian organizations.
So Doctors Without Borders.
Doctors Without Borders, exactly, mm-hmm. The international Doctors Without Borders. And then people who donate through the website and through fundraising events and things like that. That's what we base on our finances. So everything comes at a cost. Everything has to be accounted for. We can't be frivolous with antibiotics or supplies or anything like that. And everything is very, very expensive because, you know, how are you going to get somebody to get some blood
everything
work?
Everything has to be shipped there. When you go, do you take medications with you?
The Greek government doesn't want medications shipped, and neither does the Jordanian government. So you're usually relying on the internal pharmacies there, which can be quite expensive. Again, as medicines are a rare commodity in these countries, they can be quite expensive. So the Greek pharmacies are where we buy most of our medications.
It must be a little surreal to go between here, your home, and there. I wonder how it changes your perspective when you're back here.
You have to reset a little bit. Fortunately, in this country, we have a lot of medical luxuries. You can see a doctor anytime, any day of the week. Even if you can't get a hold of your doctor, you go to the emergency room. Medications are everywhere. CT scans, all these wonderful inventions are at the doctor's disposal at any time. While our healthcare system isn't perfect, it makes you really appreciate everything else that they have. It makes you as a patient and as a doctor and as a family member really appreciative of what you have. And it makes it so frustrating over there when you're practicing So it is hard to reset. It is hard to say, you know, this is such a blessing to be able to practice in this country and to be a patient in this country and have family members in this country.
Well, and I also just think of, you mentioned frustration. I just think of the scope of the scale of what we're seeing in terms of when we hear numbers, I think it's really hard for people to process when we think about 2 million people each in Lebanon and Turkey, 1 million people in Jordan, hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq or Egypt. And I wonder, does it feel for you sometimes, does it feel like you're just one person and there are millions of people who need help? I'm sure that's something you've thought about.
Yeah, you know, when I first started this, I was a little naive, I'll be honest. I thought, you know, just finishing medical school that I was going to go save the world and so on and so forth. But really what it comes down to is you can only do your part and you can only – you have to do your part and you have to be okay with – you can only do your part. You can't save the whole world. You can't do everything, but you at least have to try and you have to do the best that you can because that's what we're here for. We're here to help each other and we're all part of the same family, whether we live here or abroad. We're all the same community. We're all in the same situation. This can happen to any of us. And if this were to happen to us, we would hope that the world wouldn't turn a blind eye to us and that they would help us out. And that's all I'm here to do is the best that I can. You're right. I'm not going to save 4 million refugees,
but I imagine that's what keeps you going back also.
But that's what keeps me going back.
What do you want people – we just have a couple minutes left, but I wonder what you want people in Illinois to know about this because you have a very unique perspective that most people here don't have because you've been there and you've seen that and you've treated people there.
So unfortunately, everything takes a political spin, especially in this day and age with the elections coming up. This notion that these refugees are terrorists is absolutely it couldn't be further from the truth. It's so insulting and ridiculous. You know, if you were just think about it logically, what terrorists in their right mind would walk or take dangerous terrain, put their whole family on a lifeboat, overcrowded lifeboat, knowing very well that they could capsize and die, then spend years and years in a refugee camp, living under a tent under horrible circumstances, with no food, no running water, risk of infection, leave their whole family else behind, leave all their wealth, all their well-beings, with the notion that perhaps there's a slight chance that there's maybe a 3% chance that somebody from America may let them come to America. Does that sound like a terrorist strategy to you?
When you talk to people, do they want to come to the U.S.? What do they tell you about where they want to go?
They want to go where there's safety. That's it. You know, if the U.S. will provide them safety, that's great. You know, they hear a lot about what Canada's doing, and that's very reassuring. But that's all they want. They want safety for their family. They want to put their kids in school. They want to be able to work. That's all they're looking for. They want to not have the fear of a bomb dropping on them anytime, to get over these psychological conditions that their kids have come to and that they have come to, where they have seen their family members either killed or tortured. These are not terrorists. These are our brothers and our sisters, and there's no difference between them and us. This idea that they are terrorists is a pure political spin to make people scared. But we as people should not be scared. We should be welcoming help because we would want the same thing if we were them. Yes, tensions are high into concentration camps. Yes, incidents happened. But wouldn't you be a little bit scared and on edge if you were going through those circumstances that they were? So we have to be better as people. This notion that we have to worry about vetting them, and sure, we should vet them, but this is the worst terrorist strategy ever debacled. If you think this is a terrorist or a terrorist strategy, terrorists have money. Terrorists can get on planes. No one would succumb their families to that kind of torture and stress if they wanted that. We as a world have to come together and unite and say, this is a horrible situation. We would never want this for our family members. Therefore, we will not let this happen to these people, and we will stand united and help them out.
Dr. Omar Al-Hitti is a medical doctor at Carl Foundation Hospital. He volunteers with the Syrian American Medical Society, telling us about the trips that he's taken. You just came back last week. When are you going back again?
I don't know. I have to – my wife and my parents are getting kind of frustrated with me. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. But
okay. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode.
Because this is how we bring in the sun. how we bring in the sun. This is how we tell everyone. This is how we bring in the sun. We'll build a secret fort where we'll hold court under the cushions. Then we can tear that sucker down.
That's Chicago musician Justin Roberts. He's a Grammy-nominated artist for his children's music. His latest album is called Lemonade. It just came out earlier this month. Last week, it charted on Billboard's Kids Album Chart. Justin's on the line with us from Chicago. Hey, Justin, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hey, Nyla. So glad to.
So how's the response been to this album so far?
It's been pretty fantastic. You know, it's a little different than the last couple that I've made that have been much more like giant rock records. And this one was done kind of live in the studio with some different musicians that I normally work with. And I've been getting great feedback. You know, I never know what people are going to like when I'm writing for kids and families. So it's been fun to hear the responses.
Well, and I should point out, and this is an important distinction I think that you always like to make, that it's kids' music, we're going to put kids in quotes, really only in its lyrical content. And why is that important for you as you're working on your music?
I guess because I'm a music fan myself. And, you know, I got started doing this in the early 90s when I was working as a preschool teacher just out of college. And I loved music, and I, you know, listened to a lot of different types of music, and I started playing different songs for kids and just realized that they, you know, had a wide array of things that they would like and enjoy, from anything from punk rock to Sam Cooke songs. And so when I started writing songs for them, I just sort of wrote what I thought was good music that had some good hooks, and they liked it. And that was kind of the beginning.
Well, and I think you often hear from parents, right, who say to you, thanks for making kids' music that's enjoyable and not super annoying, right?
Yeah, and also just like I listen after I drop my kids off at school and continue listening to the record. And, you know, I love most of all probably when parents share with me moments where they hear something in a song and they're like, oh my gosh, that just totally brought back a memory of my childhood that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And you know, that sort of thing. So when it's working on both levels for the kids and the adults, and they can enjoy it together, that's kind of the goal.
Well, and as you say that, I wonder if we can play one of your songs. This is called Must Be This Tall, because I think there's a couple moments in this, and obviously I'm a really short person, so I think I've always been like, this has always been something that personally I always remember, even as an adult, I'm one of the shortest people in the room. But let's take a listen to this song, and then we can talk about it. Okay, this is Must Great. Be This Tall. It's from Justin Roberts' new album, Lemonade.
Straighten my spine, must be this tall to ride. This year is gonna be different. This year is gonna be fine. My heart skips a beat, a little shaky inside. Must be this tall to ride, to ride. Must be this tall to ride. Tried to make up straight with a comb, must be this tall to ride. Measured over 47 inches at home, must be this tall to ride. To see that wooden man with his outstretched hand. I told my mama wasn't scared, but I kinda lied. Must be this tall to ride. When we got to the front of that line and we stepped up, be this tall to ride. There won't be no more turning around. Must be this tall to ride.
This must be this tall off of Justin Roberts' latest album. It's called Lemonade. Hey, Justin, so there's a couple things I want to ask you about that song. I'll get to the music in a second, but let's start with the message, because I think that is what we were talking about, right? About how they're sort of relatable across ages. I will say you're a pretty tall guy. So I feel like, did you really have this problem when you were a kid? Did you have a growth spurt after I met you? Because you're tall.
Well, I did have an older brother who's 3 years older. So I think I had maybe the experience of sometimes not being tall enough, or, you know, watching him and his friends play basketball or something and not being able to do it quite the same. But I didn't have the experience of, you know, being short my whole life, which I've talked to people about after having written
right,
the song
yeah.
and have shared those stories with me.
But do you think, I wonder if there's the thing about it is there's sort of a message that I think is relatable across all ages, right? Like if you're good enough for something, right? And do you think, I wonder how much adults maybe take that message to heart more when they hear it from a kid's perspective?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, it's been fun. We played that song pretty early on live before the record was out. And that was one where, you know, we played it and then we played all the songs that people already knew, and kids would come up and say that was their favorite song and what record was it on. And I was like, wow, so kids get it. I mean, that, you know, I never know if it's going to work on that level, but from an adult perspective, like, it worked when I was writing it. It felt emotional to me, and it felt like, even though I can't totally relate to how it feels to be short all your life, sorry, Nyla.
Right, yeah.
You know, the idea of like, this year is going to be different. Maybe I can do it this time. You know, that sort of thing resonated with me.
And so how do you, I wonder, can you take me a little bit into the thought process of how you write your, like with this song, where did it come from, the idea to do this?
Well, the funny thing is, I think sometimes the best ideas I have come from other people, which is the case of this song. I got a text message from one of my friends whose child used to listen to my music a long time ago and who's now probably 17 or 18. And she said, have you ever written a song about trying to ride the roller coaster and wondering if you're tall enough? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's an excellent idea. And so I started, I just started sort of singing. First thing I did was Googled the sign, and like, it's like, oh yeah, it must be this tall to ride. And then I was like, I wonder how tall you have to be on a roller coaster generally. And like, just sort of got some facts. And then I started writing various versions of the song. I think I wrote like four different melodies, and some of them were a little bit more like a pop song. And then I kind of settled on this kind of old folk music style of having the chorus repeat the words a lot, because I thought it would be good for singing along. And
it's a little twangier. You know, it's interesting, too, because it's like, I feel like
yeah.
it's a little twangier than your usual music, like they're than it previous
is.
Albums. So that's kind
yeah.
of a different place you're in with this album than you were before.
Yeah, and I think part of it was I started this record thinking I'm going to make a simpler record with less chords and acoustic instruments and record it live in the studio. And, you know, eventually we decided on the musicians and came up with Robbie Foulkes on acoustic guitar and vocals on that last one, and John Abbey playing upright bass, and our drummer playing like cardboard boxes and strange percussion items. And once I sort of knew that that was happening, or even began the record with that in mind, I started writing in that way and stopping myself if I got too complicated or got too much like a rock song.
Yeah, you recorded this live also. So how was it recording everything at the same time? Did that feel better? Because, and it's interesting because so much of your performances are live in front of audiences too.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I like doing it both ways, but the thing that was great about this experience was playing with some musicians I don't play with very often. There were just moments in each take
that were like, wow, that was magic, that happened, and that was so cool. And like, there are times where I can actually hear myself smiling when I'm singing because I was listening to something that was going on in the room. And, you know, that sort of thing I think is exciting for people to hear. And it was exciting for us to record that way.
And as you say that, with how you're trying to keep it simple, I think you use a lot of everyday items, whether you're using cardboard boxes or paint cans or... how do kids react when they see someone using that at a live show?
That was really fun because we actually just did a CD release show at Space up in Evanston 2 weeks ago. And Gerald brought the kit that he, or basically the kit that he played in on the record, with literally a cardboard box over his snare and all these funny various things that he would hit during the show. And I watched kids watch him during the concert and just were like glued to him. And before the show, kids were wandering on stage and Gerald kind of showed them some of the stuff that he was playing. And I think they respond to that. I like having a variety of instruments on the record in addition to the acoustic guitar, banjo, upright bass and drums. There's, you know, cellos and harpsichords and violas and fiddles and a bunch of different things. So, you know, it has a variety of sounds, even though there's not a lot of amps and electronic instruments.
Justin,
other records.
You know, we had the hip hop classical duo Black Violin on the show a couple weeks ago, and they told us about kids moshing at their shows. They had like kitty mosh pits. Do you have kitty mosh pits? What's the reaction from kids at your show?
We do. It's super fun. I mean, that's the thing that I discovered early on about kids, is that they're the most honest audience you can have. And so they will just jump up and start dancing without worrying about who's around them and whether people are looking at them like some adults might. And, you know, if they're bored, they'll walk away and say, "Mom, I want to go home." So you have to really
be on your
best to make sure that you're performing at a level that keeps them engaged, which, you know, part of that element is just keeping it really interactive in the concert. And, you know, sometimes like with Must Be This Tall to Ride, I think about that when I'm writing the song. I'm like, well, this is going to work well because it says the same lyrics over and over and the audience can sing that. I can sing the other stuff. But other times I write the song first and then try to figure out how we're going to keep people engaged during the show. So it's fun both ways.
Well, listen, Justin, thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. Let's end
Glad
by listening to the title track. So Justin Roberts' latest album is called Lemonade, and this is the title track, Chicago-based Justin Roberts. Justin, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla. I'm glad to be here.
It was the hottest day in July. We were sweaty on the porch, just my brother and I. My dad said, "Boys, when we were young, this is the way we lived when the heat just stung. We'd mix the sweet with the sour wall, and we could just sit there for hours, wall. With the ice and the lemon and the sugar and the shade, we were all grown up. Lemonade."
That does it for this special encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.
Cut a hole in the top of a coffee can. It's how we get paid, you know.